Happy Friday, everybody. My name is Mike Cutler. I'd like to welcome all of you to the Michael Cutler Hour on USA Talk Radio Network. It's a pleasure to join you this and every Friday to have discussions about the issues that you are not very likely to hear on probably most of the radio or television programs that are out there. Today, our country faces a variety of challenges, a variety of threats, and it's important that we, the people, in accordance with what the First Amendment allows, in fact, requires, hold the meetings, hold the discussions, exchange ideas, and it doesn't have to be that we come from the same place, either politically or philosophically, but it's about exchanging ideas and speaking honestly and candidly. And to this end, I'd like to start my program today by reminding everybody of the wording in the First Amendment of our Constitution, the First Amendment of our Bill of Rights. It's a very important amendment, obviously. It's item one on the list as the founding fathers of this great nation understood what was needed to create this experiment in democratic republic. And here is the exact wording for those of you who most likely don't remember the words. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. I want to focus for a quick moment on the last half of the First Amendment, where it says that Congress shall make no laws respecting the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. It sounds quite a bit like the demonstrations that we are seeing in Wall Street, quite a bit like the demonstrations we are starting to see in other cities across this great nation. And what is so astonishing to me, and you know, I lay my cards on the table, folks. I am a registered Democrat. I will tell you, I don't know where the Democratic Party has gone. I think they need a new GPS. Frankly, I think both political parties are morally bankrupt, to put it as bluntly as I know how. But look at the way that the politicians on the left, the Democrats, and they're not really even Democrats anymore, have vilified the members of the Tea Party. You know, Bill Maher gets on there with that little grin of his and calls members of the Tea Party teabaggers. I'm not going to go there, but for those of you who have a gutter mind or understand that kind of language, you'll know what he's saying. And it's pretty disgraceful, teabaggers. But of course, it's cute because let's nail the people who are to the right of where we are. And by the way, and those of you who are part of the Tea Party, you know as well as I do, not all Tea Partiers are extreme conservatives. When I was in Texas speaking on July 4th, about 2 years ago, at a Tea Party-sponsored event, and there were perhaps 15 or 20,000 people in the audience at the time that I spoke on that sweltering afternoon, many of the people I met as I strolled through the crowd, both before and after I had gone up on stage, told me that they were disenchanted, disenfranchised Democrats. The Tea Party represents a vote for none of the above. And yes, there are a lot of conservatives, fiscal conservatives, social conservatives. You know, that's the thing about America. You can't say, well, the average American votes this way or the average American votes that way. The politicians like to play that game. The news media loves to play that game, and they do it in a variety of ways, and we'll get to that in a bit. But first things first. So we have the Tea Party, a reaction to policies by the Obama administration, the TARPs, the bailouts of both the Bush administration and now the bailouts and the economic stimulus packages of this administration. And Americans, rightfully so, greatly concerned, greatly appalled by what they're seeing is squandering the largesse of this country to the point where our children, our grandchildren, and God knows, perhaps their children will continue to pay off the bills that this administration and the prior administration ran up. And what's astonishing is that just 15, 20 years ago, we had a surplus. You'd never know it today. We are bankrupt. Europe is bankrupt. Greece is teetering on the abyss, on the edge of the abyss, right at the edge. So people are looking at all this, and they form the Tea Party, and they say, wow, we've had it. So immediately, the folks who were more liberal than they were, oh my God, these people are crazy, they're wacky, they're the right-wing nuts and all the other business. Well, now we've got the folks on Wall Street. And let's be very honest about it, okay? Yes, it is true that I don't doubt that some of the people who are out there demonstrating are the usual assortment of, you know, street theater, as I call it, the socialists, the anarchists, the wackaloons, the people who have nowhere else to be, so they may as well be there. That's great. But let's be honest about this. As you are noticing, and I'm sure if you're paying attention, you're seeing this, increasingly the people who are taking to the streets aren't wacky. They aren't professional welfare recipients. They aren't escapees from the padded cell. Increasingly, what we are seeing are members of the Teamsters Union, truck drivers, construction workers, people who are losing their jobs, nurses, teachers. You know, I'm pro-union with certain caveats. I'm a very big believer in unions that don't exceed the bounds that they should be establishing as the boundary of how far you go. When teachers' unions protect bad teachers that have a harmful effect on those kids that may well last them a lifetime, hobble their abilities to be educated and successful and productive, well, then there's something wrong with the union. When unions go out there and demand that we allow more illegal aliens into the country because they are in this headlong rush to get ever more members so they get more dues and more power, well, of course they're wrong. But when unions seek to create balance between the wealthy who run the companies so that the workers get their fair share for a good, honest, hard day's work, then I think the union is onto something. My dad was a construction worker. He was a plumber. It was a tough way to make a living. You know, if he worked 1 hour and it started to rain and there was no roof on the building that he was working on, he went home, he got paid for the 1 hour. You know, there was no nonsense. So the bosses held all the cards, it seemed. And they could easily just lay somebody off. They didn't like the way you were working. You weren't moving fast enough. Whatever the deal was, boom, you're gone. We'll bring somebody else in. There was no job protection, very few fringe benefits. So, you know, what I'm talking about here is reasonableness. I mean, that's really what I think, folks, has been missing from the dialogue, reasonableness. Either we're on full throttle or we're standing on the brakes. There's nobody steering the bus down the middle of the road, more or less, with minor variations and talking about reasonableness. I certainly love an ice-cold beer on a hot summer day. There's nothing better than that cold brew on that kind of a sweltering day. But that's not the same thing as being falling down drunk. I like a nice glass of wine with a good meal. But again, not the same situation as rolling around in the street because you're now obliterated because you drank God knows how many bottles. Moderation. Reasonableness, a sense of proportion. And that's really what's been lacking. The arguments have been getting more and more strident, more and more vicious, more and more nasty. The American people have probably never felt more disenfranchised from their own governments. Both parties seem to be representing the very wealthy, the very powerful, the special interest groups. The average American, quite frankly, seems to be getting lost in the shuffle. And then today, this is really remarkable. You know, you have the Republicans referring to the Wall Street occupiers, if you want to call them that, the street demonstrators, a growing mob. Believe it or not, Eric Cantor, leader of the Republican Party, here's a quote from ABC News, and I know the news can very often be very biased and get things sideways, but here it says, Cantor calls the Wall Street protesters a growing mob. And I've seen politicians come out and say, well, you know, you don't like that you don't have enough money? Go to work. What do you mean, go to work? You know, what's astonishing, and if you're honest about this, folks, what you're listening to is the pablum that we keep getting spoon-fed by the news media, by the politicians, and it's coming at us from every direction. We're being told that the recession ended in June of 2009. How do you square the idea that the recession is over, long over, 2 years plus over, when we still have officially a 9.1% unemployment rate And you know what, folks? You and I both know this. We're smarter than that. We know that if you look at underemployment, if you look at the people who have given up looking for jobs, if you look at the people who have exhausted their benefits so that they're no longer being counted, I would not doubt that in some places in this country, over 20% of the people are unemployed. And the recession is over? Are we supposed to head out into the street and dance a little dance and be all excited and say, yippee, it's over. Good times are here again. Good times aren't here again. Banks aren't lending money. People are losing their homes. People are unable to pay the tuition for their kids' educations. And we're being told, all's right with the world. The recession's over. And you know, I've been enjoying Herman Cain. I've been thinking of him as a viable candidate. And he comes out yesterday and basically says, well, you know, the problem with those protesters is let them get a job. You know, let them get to work. And then he tries to correct it, from what I understand, when he was on MSNBC later on in the day. But goodness gracious, Herman Cain, what are you thinking about? The people who are out of work, many of them, are not people who are used to being out of work, people who don't want to work. These are hardworking, diligent people, and they've lost their jobs. Jobs have been outsourced, foreign workers have been brought in, and some companies have gone belly up. And, you know, I've been on Lou Dobbs Tonight many times when he was over at CNN, and Lou really broke it down into two broad categories of Americans, that were or two broad problems for Americans. Broken borders, the failure to control who comes across our borders, and exporting America, the idea that companies move their factories, their methods of production, around the world so they wouldn't have to deal with environmental regulations or labor laws or minimum wage, none of that. This is about maximizing profit. And look, let's be honest, I think we all agree, every company in existence is really in the same business. They really are. I don't care if it's a service company. I don't care if it's a company that manufactures goods. Whatever it is, companies serve one primary purpose. One way or the other, they are supposed to generate profit. That's what capitalism is about. You have a good idea. You have a good product. You offer a unique service. You go out there. You market it. You sell it. You make money. It's as simple as that, and that's what made America America. But again, let's come back to this concept of reasonableness. And no, I don't think the government should control wages, only in the government sector, not in the private sector. I don't think the government has the right to go to General Motors and say, oh, wait a minute, your CEO is making too much money. I have to tell you, I was furious when Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, went after the car makers because their CEOs who showed up for a congressional hearing in Washington flew into Washington on their business jets. Oh, you guys with those business jets, there's something wrong with that. Well, no, there isn't. I do a lot of traveling. I do speaking engagements all over the United States. Travel is not glamorous the way it used to be. It's a major pain in the rear end. You stand on long lines. God knows you get x-rayed, which really concerns me. I think we get enough radiation. We don't need to be dosed. People have given up their expectations of privacy. And you can waste an awful lot of time at an airport waiting to get on a flight. Flights get delayed. All sorts of nonsense goes on. And then if you need to fly into a small town, you have connecting flights. It gets absurd. A business jet can be a very effective business tool. So you know, this nonsense of vilifying corporate executives because they have business jets is crazy. And by the way, the aviation industry is a major contributor to America's economic growth. Why would we want to vilify corporations that make airplanes, vilify the pilots who fly them, the mechanics who maintain them? There's a lot of American jobs involved in this business. And most importantly, it helps to make those executives who are paid very high salaries more productive. It means that while they're in the air, it's easier for them to work. They spend less time traveling because they can go from point to point in a smaller jet. There's a whole bunch of reasons, and I'm not going to get into the business of aviation with you today, but I will tell you that this game that the politicians play of pitting one group against another group, this divide and conquer strategy, is literally tearing our country apart. E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. That's our national motto. You'd never know it listening to the politicians. On the left, the Democrats are screaming about the Tea Party. Now you've got the Republicans railing about the demonstrators. And then we go back to the First Amendment. The right of Americans, of our citizens, to peaceably assemble and to seek redress of grievances. Well, if the demonstrators go out and go crazy and start trashing stuff, that's another story. But peaceful demonstrators saying to the government, what are you doing? Saying to the government, we know what goes on with those campaign contributions. We know that these wealthy folks and these corporations are getting the best government money can buy. That's not what the founding fathers had in mind. There have been some pretty horrific, in my view, Supreme Court decisions that enable corporations to be treated as individuals when they make campaign contributions. We're getting away from the idea that this is government by the people, not government by the corporation. I get so angry and so frustrated sometimes that I think we ought to rename the House of Representatives the House of Corporate Interests. And indeed it is. You know, the idea that corporations dump millions of dollars into political campaigns and now they can pay unlimited amounts of money for advertising to oppose a candidate they don't like, which I'm certain will endear them to the hearts of the candidate who runs against the guy that they don't like. We see where the wealthy and where corporations make contributions to both candidates running for the same office. You know, there's a Democrat running for the governorship and there's a Republican, and they give to both campaigns. Are they doing it because they want to see one guy win over the other? Not necessarily. I think they want to make sure they win. Now, I don't know how you address that. You know, sometimes I think maybe you should be prohibited from contributing to both campaigns in the same race. But then people have talked to me about the First Amendment, and people have the right to do what they want to do. So it really gets dicey. But we understand what we are witnessing. The folks with lots of money who wield lots of power are able to buy access, able to buy legislation by making those contributions and getting politicians to line up with them, whether it's the Chamber of Commerce demanding that the administration continue to issue, to include more countries in the insane visa waiver program, whether it's the hotel and hospitality industry that have joined with the Chamber of Commerce and even with the manufacturers to make it easier for foreign nationals to come here. You know, look, I think travel is wonderful. I think tourism is wonderful. But we need to be cautious that we don't let people into our country who want to do harm to us, who are involved with terrorism, who are fugitives from justice, who are members of criminal organizations. And believe me, it's a real problem. There are millions of people in our country who are lawfully admitted. They come through the visa process or the visa waiver program, and then they disappear. The official government estimate is that there's 5 million such visa violators, overstayers, and people working without permission or people who've committed felonies once they were lawfully admitted. And I have friends at DHS who tell me that there may be twice as many. And yet there are fewer than 300 special agents at ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, who are in the hunt for those visa violators. This is crazy. A number of the terrorists of 9/11 were visa violators. So we have fewer than 300 ICE agents looking for visa violators. But TSA has 60,000 employees searching grandma's diaper, as we saw at one airport, some 95-year-old lady who's in terrible health, on her last legs, literally, in a wheelchair. And, you know, they searched her, they patted her down, and one of these folks at TSA said, wow, I think I felt something in her diaper. Well, no doubt it was brown and smelly. I mean, this is an absurdity. So you look at where these corporations are wielding incredible influence on our politicians, and then you look at how the politicians push back against the people they're supposed to be representing. On the one hand, the Democrats scream about the Tea Party, and on the other hand, the Republicans are screaming about the demonstrators in Wall Street and people who've now taken to demonstrating across the country. And what resonated for me 2 days ago was a kid on the Brooklyn College campus, my old alma mater. And this kid was very articulate and very worked up. He said, look, my tuition is going up, student services going down, and the likelihood that I will even get a job once I graduate, after I put in all this money, all this time, all this energy, what will I get for a job? We are importing foreign workers. Just a couple of days ago, Mayor Bloomberg, the guy who said that anybody who ran for more than two terms in office was disgusting, and then he himself ran for two terms, the guy who in one of his campaigns, from what I remember reading, spent over $70 million of his own money to make certain he won the election. Talk about hubris. My gosh, you know, the average American gets a couple of bucks together. He says, wow, I'm going to buy myself a sports car. If he's not quite that affluent or he has different ideas, he says, wow, I'm going to buy myself a big screen TV, you know, whatever. I'm going to add a new den in my home, right? Here's a guy who says, I'm going to spend $70 million basically and buy the mayoralty of the city of New York. Holy smoke. So here's Mayor Bloomberg who says, hey, you know what we need to do? We need to have unlimited numbers of H-1B visas. Now, for those of you not familiar with the alphabet soup of visas and the law, and for those of you familiar with the way that I like to explain things, I spent 30 years working for what used to be the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And in fact, this week, it's kind of difficult for me to come to terms with it, but this week I celebrated my 40th anniversary of having been sworn in as an immigration inspector. I've been involved with this issue for a very, very, very long time, longer than I wish. And then I look in the mirror and see all the gray hair, and I say, yep, that must be me, the old guy. But, you know, if you look at the H-1B visas, these are visas that are supposed to be given to people in the high-tech industries, computer programmers, scientists, technicians, engineers, and so forth. Because ostensibly, these are people who have high skills, and there's not enough people in our country, supposedly, who can take those jobs, so we import them. Well, guess what, folks? In point of fact, there are many Americans who have those skills, who have the education, who have the experience, who have a burning desire to work in those industries, and guess what? They're not working in those industries. They've been laid off. Because corporations understand that by importing foreign workers, they can pay lower wages, they can get away with worse benefits or maybe no benefits at all. So this is about cutting costs to maximize profit, but meanwhile, we're destroying our own country. There's a mythology that we're always hearing. America was built by immigrants. And of course, my rejoinder for that is the difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar, and we're talking about legal immigrants who built the country. But it's not just that these were immigrants who built America. If a country opens its borders to the world and says, come one, come all, or kind of like I'm trying to think of the host on the Price is Right used to say, come on down. That is not necessarily a prescription for success. It could be a prescription for chaos, anarchy, whatever, crime, terrorism. What built America wasn't simply that we threw the doors open. It was that we were careful about who we admitted. You know, the open borders crowd, the immigration anarchists waxed so poetic about Ellis Island. Oh, my God, they've closed Ellis Island. Well, you know, if we reopened it, the ACLU and Metro, LULAC and La Raza and all the other usual suspects would probably be out there screaming bloody murder. Because in point of fact, Ellis Island was a quarantine station. It was built on an island. They had Alcatraz on the west coast. We had Ellis Island on the east coast. And both were islands. And that's where they built the facilities. Alcatraz, of course, The Rock. If you saw the Sean Connery movie, great flick. Was designed to keep prisoners from making their way to California. You didn't get off the Rock unless the authorities wanted you to. You didn't get off Ellis Island unless the authorities wanted you to. But there they are screaming, oh, my God, we've closed down Ellis Island. What are we to do? What are we to do? Well, the point was, from what I have heard recently, about 40% of the people who landed on Ellis Island in those ships way back when were turned around because they were found to have mental problems, communicable diseases. Perhaps they became aware that these folks were wanted in other countries for crimes they had committed. So this was a place to quarantine and screen people. It wasn't a free-for-all. In fact, the immigration laws are supposed to keep the bad guys out. So it's not just people coming across the border willy-nilly that builds a country, that creates the success story that America became. what made America, America, even more than the fact that we had all these immigrants, is the fact that we had a vibrant, upwardly mobile middle class. That in America, anybody, and I mean anybody, or the son of anybody, could go to college, go to a trade school, acquire a skill, acquire some way that made them unique in the marketplace. Maybe they were performers, entertainers, you name it. I mean, look at how many career paths there are. And in America, anybody who worked hard, who acquired that special skill, that special education, who showed some gumption and had a little bit of creativity and a little old-fashioned luck, could excel and be the next success story. I mean, look at the people who became the success stories. This week, the world mourns the passing of Steve Jobs, classic example of the American dream. He was adopted by a middle-class family. He went to college. In the middle of college, he said, boy, this is a waste of my time. And he built himself a little laboratory in his adoptive parents' garage and started to fiddle around with computers. And, of course, we all know that ultimately this is how the Apple Computer Company was born. Think of all the innovative stuff that came out of Steve Jobs' brilliant mind. He is the contemporary answer to Thomas Alva Edison. He is the contemporary answer to Henry Ford and to a whole line of inventors, visionaries, people who took our society, took the human race in a different direction. Where would we be today without computers? You know, when I was a kid, everybody talked about flying cars. Well, we really didn't get the flying cars, but we did get computers. And those computers have provided us with opportunities to live lives that are so much richer and so much more incredibly different than it ever could have been without the computers. And there was just a handful of people leading the charge, and certainly one of the critical visionaries was Steve Jobs. So this is the American dream. We used to have a wonderful expression in America. You don't even hear it anymore. Build a better mousetrap and the world will beat a path to your door. Come up with a better idea, find a way to manufacture it and market it, and you'll be the next success story. That's what built America. That's why people went to college. My mother came here from Poland, ahead of the Holocaust, as a teenage girl, very bright lady, but she only had a fourth grade education. And she hammered it into my head from the time that I was 5 years old, you're going to college. My dad was born here. His parents came from Russia. He had to help support his family. He had an eighth grade education. He beat it into my head, you're going to college. You're going to college. It was like a mantra. You're going to college. What are you going to be when you grow up? I don't know, but I'm going to college, right? That was what was hammered at. And not just for me, all of my friends, same deal. And many of them came from immigrant parents, and they were hammered into their heads. You're going to college. I actually have visions of my friends asleep at night and the parents sitting next to the kid's bed, subliminally whispering in the child's ear, you're going to college. You're going to college. Because we all went to college. And many of us did do okay. I became a federal agent. Some of the guys that I went to school with became surgeons and lawyers and school teachers and engineers. I mean, my goodness gracious, the key to success in America was education, was taking the initiative and running with it. And today, because the government, being bought off by the wealthy, by the powerful, don't give a damn about the middle class. Don't give a damn about the working poor. And President Obama stands there and tries to sound, I mean, and this is what infuriates me about this president, quite frankly, folks, stands there and says, these people are right. They're hardworking and they are diligent and they're not getting what they deserve. And he goes off. And nobody has called the president on the issue of what he's done with immigration. See, immigration isn't a single issue. Everyone says, oh, immigration, minor issue, minor, insignificant. No, immigration is not a single issue. It's a singular issue. And I want you to think about why it's singular, why it's so unusual. By not securing the borders, we leave ourselves vulnerable to criminals and terrorists. By not securing the borders, we allow people to come to this country who do the work. And by the way, the other mythology and the other side just spews lies As sure as the sun's going to rise in the east, you hear the nonsense. First of all, they will tell you that I'm a nativist. Hardly the case. You're a racist if you want the border secure because this is all about Mexico. No, it's not all about Mexico. Yes, Mexico sends us lots of illegal aliens, but the immigration laws are blind as to race, religion, or ethnicity. It's simply about keeping out people whose presence would be harmful to us. But they make all these great statements, right? They make all these claims and allegations, and most people don't have critical thinking skills. They hear what someone says, and they go out and say, oh, it must be true. I mean, you know, they were able to not only successfully market and sell the pet rock in America a number of years ago, but if that wasn't dopey enough, a year later they made even more money with the training manual for the pet rock. And that's what goes on. Oh, the folks that come across the border are doing the work Americans won't do. Let me ask you folks a question, because I suspect if you're listening to me, you're brighter than that. Do you really believe that there are jobs Americans won't take if they can't find any work, if they're losing their homes to foreclosure, if they can't put food on the table and feed their children? What job won't you take? And if you look at what day laborers have been doing, they undermine and undercut the American craftsmen, the tradesmen, the bricklayers, the carpenters, the plumbers, the electricians, the roofers. They're getting hammered, the concrete workers, because these day laborers will work for the contractors, which means that they pay these guys a lot less. Safety standards go out the window. The quality of the work day laborers do, by the way, is usually really, as we would say in Yiddish, dreck. It's garbage. But it's cheaper. And it's not that the American consumer saves money because they hire a day laborer. It's that the contractor who hires the day laborer to do the work that he needs to get done so that he can be paid for the job saves money but does not generally pass the savings along to the consumer. What he passes along to the consumer is slipshod work. I mean, you know, if you go to Better Business Bureau, see how many home improvement companies are nightmare companies to deal with. And part of it is the people they employ. I mean, who would you rather have building your home? A craftsman, a carpenter, a plumber, people like my dad who went through an apprenticeship program and were highly responsible, highly trained, and highly experienced, or some guy who has no idea about what to do, and they just tell him, you know, hammer these two boards together and put some paint on this and go do something about that. And the guy slaps it together, and the guy comes in and says, yeah, give me a check for $10,000. He's on his way to some other guy's house the next morning. Increasingly, that's what we're seeing. And again, it's not just the bottom rung jobs. It's the H-1B visas. It's the technicians. It's in all parts of the economy that we are inundating America with foreign workers at a time when American workers are continuing to lose their jobs. This makes no sense. This is worse than bringing sand to the beach, bringing in more foreign workers. This is like giving money and food to your neighbors across the street when your own children are going to bed hungry at night. This generation, our children's generation right now, for the first time in I don't know how many decades, has an expectation of living less well than their parents did. This is a first for me. My generation always assumed that each successive generation would live better than the one that preceded it. And that was the reason why. Because we went to get educated, we got the education, we went out there, and we made use of the education. How do you make use of an education when a guy like Bloomberg is running around saying, we need to bring in unlimited numbers of foreign workers? He actually complained and said it was unreasonable that companies don't have access to the workers they need. I mean, this is crazy stuff. They have access to the workers if they pay them a living wage. So you see all of this going on, and Obama knows what he needs to say to make it sound as though he's saying the right things. And then you've got some flat-footed Republicans who go out there vilifying the protesters who are angry and frustrated, and maybe they're scared, maybe they're apprehensive. Maybe some of those people out there demonstrating are in the midst of a foreclosure. The bank sent them the statement, you know, you got so much time to pay up or get out of the house. How frantic would you be if, God forbid, that happened to you? So I'm watching the demonstrators. I'm watching the presidential debates. I'm listening to the candidates, looking for a spark of genius. I got to tell you, it's hard to find it. It's hard to find it. You had Rick Perry saying, people that don't want to give in-state tuition to illegal aliens don't have a heart. Rick Perry needed to talk to that young man who was on a local radio program here in Brooklyn, New York, who said that he didn't think he would have a job when he got out of college, even after spending all that time and money on his education. Well, when we give illegal alien students in-state tuition, that means that less money is paid. And by the way, by educating illegal alien kids, what are we really saying? We're really saying is that at some point we're going to expect to put you to work in America. So we are importing competition. You know, one of the things that I do is I write for a wonderful organization by the name of CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. And if you look at where California is, I mean, economically, that state is in the dumpster. They are in a state of disaster, that state. And CAPS led the charge, Californians for Population Stabilization. And their website, by the way, is a great website, and I strongly urge you to go to their website. It's capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. Or you can go to my website, and if you're listening to me tonight, folks, likely you've been to my website. That's michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. And so, you know, you listen to the nonsense being spewed by the politicians. You listen to how we're being told that, you know, it's one group or the other, where we're vilifying each other. And meanwhile, Americans across the board are being made to suffer. And what the politicians have also done, and this is kind of really worrying, is they've been making presumptions about the Spanish vote, the black vote, the Jewish vote. And I wrote a commentary for CAPS about this business. And I have to tell you that to my thinking, you may not agree with me, this is really what prejudice is about. Because the idea behind prejudice is that you look at a person, and without knowing that individual personally, as a human being, as a singular entity, you make presumptions. You know, if the guy is black, if the guy is Hispanic, if the guy is white, if he's a Catholic, if he's a Protestant, if he's a Baptist, if he's a Jew, oh, we know what he is. Could you be more bigoted than that? Think about what you're really saying. You look at somebody and say, oh, that guy is a Latino. We know what he wants. That's bigotry. Does every Latino have the same concerns? Does every Latino vote the same way in an election? Is every Latino the same? Of course not. Jewish people, black people, name the group. When you start to break Americans down and put them into little cubby holes and then say, we know what that guy is going to want because he's a Latino, he's a Jew, he's a black, he's this, he's... That's at the root of prejudice and bigotry. Well, Raza screams bloody murder about anybody who says, look, let's secure the border, make sure we don't let in criminals and terrorists, and let's make sure we don't wind up bringing in competitors for Americans who are out of work. And by the way, Americans who are out of work aren't just white. Let's be very blunt about this. And in fact, America's minorities are doing worse in this tough economy than American white folks. White folks are doing badly enough, but the Latinos and the blacks are doing even worse. And the Latinos are exhibiting the highest level of poverty in America. So how can anyone say, oh, if you're a Latino, you're going to want open borders. You're going to want to give green cards and amnesty to all the illegal aliens who are here. This is absolutely crazy. It's absolutely crazy, but that's exactly what they do. They talk about the Latino vote, and a lot of these idiotic politicians buy into this stupidity, and they say, oh, yeah, we've got to appeal to the Latinos. We want their vote. So the way we'll get their vote is to promise amnesty for illegal aliens. I have got to tell you that that kind of reasoning is nothing short of bigotry. I mean, that's exactly what you're talking about. There's no way of sugarcoating it. You are absolutely talking about bigotry if that's really what you think we're talking about. So you have politicians pandering to a voter base that they think they have, saying, oh, we'll appeal to these folks because we're going to give them the opportunity to come here illegally, but once they get here, we'll put them on a pathway to citizenship. This is idiotic. It's dangerous. We don't know these people's names. So suddenly, we have millions of people who are going to apply for lawful status, probably using a fake name if they're bad guys, if they're on a terror watch list or they're criminals. There's no easy way. You know, don't think just fingerprinting somebody. You know, this isn't CSI. This is the real world. I can tell you this as an agent. If there's no record of that guy's fingerprints in our system, and he comes from a country where there's chaos in their fingerprint system, if they even have one, that guy's going to come back with no record, which will make everybody believe that he's a good guy. You know, oh, no problem here. And then he gives a fake name. His real name may be on every terror watch list in the world, but the fake name comes up clean because it's fake. It doesn't exist. It's made up. It's fantasy. So, I mean, this is crazy. And then you look at the immigration laws, and we probably should say, don't try this at home. Because if you aid, abet, encourage, or induce aliens to enter our country illegally, violate the law, run the borders, or if you encourage, aid, abet, or induce an alien who's already here illegally in flagrant disregard for the law to continue to stay here illegally, you're committing a felony. A felony. And yet, that's exactly what the president has been doing. That's what George W. Bush did. That's what members of Congress are doing. If you tell illegal aliens, we want to put you on a pathway to U.S. citizenship, we want to give you the ability to remain here and work, not only are you aiding and abetting, inducing and encouraging people who are already here, but I have to tell you, desperate illegal aliens in their home countries are not ignoring these speeches and these promises being made by these high-level American politicians. So if they're sitting there thinking, is it worth the risk? Is it worth paying a smuggler $5,000, $10,000, whatever? What's going to happen when I get here? And the Obama administration has made it plain, very clear to everybody. They've certainly transmitted a very clear message. If you come here and you have no criminal convictions, we have no interest in removing you. In fact, we want to put you on a pathway to citizenship. Isn't that a great way of inducing somebody to come here? I mean, if you wrote a letter to some guy and said, hey, listen, if you run the border, I've got a job for you, I guarantee you ICE would come to your house, knock on the door, and take you into custody and go before a grand jury with that letter, get an indictment, and charge you with criminal violations, as they should, by the way. Well, is it any different when the president says these things? Actually, it is. And the way it's different is it's not him speaking to one illegal alien and saying, hey, listen, if you can get yourself into America, I've got a job and an apartment for you. This is the president of the United States, and he's addressing would-be illegal aliens across the planet, saying, hey, if you can come here, we'll take care of you. If you can run the border, we'll see to it that you get to stay here. Let me just read the section of law. And if you like, folks, you can go to my website, michaelcutler.net, or just write this down. So if you have any doubts about what I'm telling you, you'll understand just how serious this nonsense really is. Title 8 of the United States Code, Section 1324A. Now, A in parenthesis, small a. Let me read this. It defines several distinct offenses related to aliens, and then it gives a subsection of law, but it doesn't matter. Just go to that Title 8 United States Code, Section 1324. Prohibits alien smuggling, domestic transportation of unauthorized aliens, concealing or harboring unauthorized aliens, encouraging or inducing unauthorized aliens to enter the United States, and engaging in a conspiracy or aiding and abetting any of the preceding acts. Section 1324A2 prohibits bringing or attempting to bring unauthorized aliens to the United States in any manner whatsoever, even at a designated port of entry. And so now we get to aiding and encouraging and inducing, and that's 1324A1A4, makes it an offense for any person who encourages or induces an alien to come to, enter, or reside in the United States knowing or in reckless disregard of the fact that such coming to, entry, or residence is or will be in violation of law. So when Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, all these other folks say, well, we're going to put up a fence on the border. Newt Gingrich, same nonsense. Jonathan Huntsman, same nonsense. Well, we'll put up a border. But the people that are here, well, we're not going to send them home. If it's a hardship, we'll take care of them. Is that not encouraging and inducing? You know, the nonsense has got to stop. If you look at the approval rating, some approval rating, it's a disapproval rating of how Americans look at the Congress, they hate Congress. I think the last statistic I read, it was the approval rating was somewhere around 13%. Could you imagine getting a 13 on an exam back in school? Hi, Mom and Dad, be proud of me, I got a 13. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. A 13 or a 14 approval rating, somewhere in that range, mid-teens. Even if it was a 20. Wow. And they wonder why people are taking to the streets. And Cantor calls the people in Wall Street a mob. The Democrats refer to the Tea Party as crazy. And what both parties are doing is trying to vilify Americans who are simply seeking a redress of grievances. And guess what? It's entirely constitutional. It's in the First Amendment. You're supposed to do this. You're supposed to have face-to-face meetings. You know, it's remarkable because at the time that this great nation was founded, the only way that debate or discourse could take place would be if you went face-to-face with the person you disagreed with. There was no telephone. There was no talk radio. There was no television, no social medium. I mean, it was, you know, either you stood in front of the person you wanted to have the conversation with or you didn't have the conversation. I mean, you know, they had the Pony Express. You could write letters, but God knows how long that would take. So, I mean, really, if you wanted to have a debate back in the 1700s, back in the 1800s, it was face-to-face. And that's why the Founding Fathers talked about the right to peaceably assemble, because they understood the need for discourse and debate. They talked about peaceably assembling, about seeking redress of grievances, because they understood the democratic process is not neat. It's not clean. Somebody once said, if you ever saw how they made sausages, you'd never have a sausage again. That's how the democratic process works. We're not supposed to agree with each other on point after point after point. You know, this is how you achieve a consensus. So when Americans take to the street, and if those of you read my commentaries, you know I always like to end my commentaries by saying that democracy is not a spectator sport, and indeed it is not. So here we have our fellow Americans, kind of almost a scene from Paddy Chayefsky's Network, you know, go to the window and scream, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. Well, they didn't go to the windows, they went to Wall Street. They went to Chicago, they went to Boston, they went to Seattle. And they're out on the streets saying, we're mad as hell, we won't take it anymore. And instead of politicians understanding, well, these are Americans, this is America, right? When it happens in the Middle East, oh, the Arab Spring, isn't this great? Meanwhile, all the radicals seem to be gaining control in these countries, and I fear we will inherit the whirlwind. We will, our friends in Israel will, certainly, a great concern. Oh, but it's great, it's the Arab Spring. But here in America, let a bunch of Americans from any political persuasion take to the street in a demonstration demanding accountability. What a thought, accountability. Could you imagine actually wanting to hold elected representatives accountable? What a novel thought. I hope it catches on. You know, I've testified before 15 congressional hearings, folks. I'm disgusted with the hearings. It's time they had listenings in Washington. Can you hear me now? So our fellow Americans take to the street asking the politicians, can you hear me now? Cantor calls them a mob on the one hand, and then the Tea Party folks are accused of being crazy on the other hand. This has to stop. This has to stop. The politicians hate the Constitution. They really do. they may derive their power from the Constitution, but just as they understand that the middle class built America, unless they're even bigger idiots than I give them credit for being, they don't care. Because once they got what they want, they don't care. So they don't care if they destroy the middle class, and they get very angry on both sides of the aisle when the American people get their voices heard, when the American people get together in places like this radio program to listen to the facts, perhaps have discussion. And, you know, you folks are always welcome to call in. I always like to engage in conversation and debate. You don't have to agree with me. And the number, by the way, is 310-982-4145, 310-982-4145. The idea is that Americans are supposed to have these debates. We're supposed to have these discussions. We are supposed to tell the politicians what we expect of them. When we go to restaurants, we're very specific about the food that we want to eat and the way that we want it prepared. And if we don't like it, we send it back. And if that doesn't work, we leave. When we go to a car dealership, we're very specific about the car we want to buy. We don't just say to a salesman, put something in my driveway and tell me how much I got to pay you. No, we'll go in there and we'll pick out the color and what model and what equipment, two doors, four doors, stick shift, automatic, whatever, sunroof, no sunroof. We tell them what we want, and then hopefully they deliver it. If they don't, we don't pay. We have got to do the same with the politicians, because these politicians don't like to be reminded of a fundamental fact. They are our employees. I don't care if you're the president of the United States or the governor of a state or the mayor of a city or a member of Congress or a member of the city council. Boys and girls, if you have an elected position, you have a boss. And the bosses that you have are the people you meet on the street because, yes, you're supposed to represent them, but you serve at their pleasure, not the other way around with these big egos. Goodness gracious, in Brooklyn we have a great term, we call it chutzpah, brass. The classic example has been eclipsed by these politicians. When I was a kid growing up in Brooklyn, chutzpah was the example, the common example, was the kid that killed both parents and then pleaded for mercy in court because he was an orphan. That was chutzpah. Well, if you want to see real chutzpah, listen to the politicians. Look at the arrogance that they demonstrate daily. You know, it was remarkable that the politicians on both sides of the aisle, Trent Lott and Nancy Pelosi, furious at talk radio. Oh, we got to get rid of the talk radio. Well, why did Trent Lott back then not like talk radio? I thought he was a conservative. I thought conservatives loved talk radio. Baloney. Baloney. These folks, if they had the opportunity, ladies and gentlemen, would keep the American people barefoot, ignorant, and what we call in government, treat them like mushrooms. Keep them in the dark and feed them a lot of manure. That's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. It's not working. And if you don't believe it's not working, look at the unemployment numbers. Look at the foreclosure rate. Look at what's happening to the housing market. And then look at the monumental disconnect where, on the one hand, the economists talk about how, oh, the recession, it ended more than 2 years ago. What are you worried about? I'll tell you what I'm worried about. We are losing our country. We are losing our ability to defend ourselves. One of the things that I do is I do speaking engagements for a number of organizations. And there's one group that I've been honored to work with, Alan Freed Associates. They do seminars for various agencies. And I was speaking in front of some military folks a couple of weeks ago, and I said, you know, I'm in awe of the military. I mean, these men and women in uniform, all the military services. Our country can never, ever, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, never, ever fully repay these gallant soldiers. I don't care what service they're in or what their particular job is within the military. Since the founding of this nation, this nation has stood on the shoulders of our military. It continues to. But I challenge you to tell me why we still have a military. And when I said that to these folks in the military, I mean, you could imagine the looks that some of these guys gave me, and I thought I needed my Kevlar vest. It's been quite some time since I've strapped one on. But I explained to them. I said, you know, in The Godfather, the famous expression was, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. In point of fact, the primary mission of the military, and there's a lot of missions, you know, we use the military to project power around the world, and it's an adjunct to foreign policy and so forth. But job one, if you had to do it in priority, you know, apple pie order, which is the most important, unless I'm getting it sideways, folks, the purpose for our military is to keep our enemy as far from our shore as possible. Well, how can we keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible when our border with Mexico is basically a speed bump? And we know there are terrorist training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil, Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda. We know that Iran has shock troops stationed in Venezuela. And I don't think anyone's going to mistake Hugo Chavez for being an ally of the United States. So we have a serious problem. We have a very serious problem. We have millions of people in the country. During the Second World War, the term infiltrator would probably come to mind, people who want to get into the country to do harm from within. And if, God forbid, there was another terrorist attack, our nuclear submarines couldn't help us. Our stealth bombers couldn't help us. The F-22 fighter plane that's been taking a lot of flak because they're having problems getting it airborne wouldn't help us. So what exactly is the mission for the military if our politicians want the borders to be left wide open, and if they're looking to give U.S. citizenship to people who are present in our country because they violated our borders and violated our laws? See, we're getting hammered, whipsawed from eight directions. And the politicians would rather we don't pay attention. They minimize immigration. They like to vilify people who say, well, we got to secure the borders. Oh, you xenophobe. I remember Arlen Specter. I think someone needed to check that guy for a flatline EEG. But I remember a couple of years ago testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee. There was Arlen Specter basically accusing me and people with my concerns, and I kid you not, you better fasten your seatbelt, of suffering from exophobia. Kid you not, exophobia. And I was startled. And everybody kind of stared at him. And then he looked down at his paper, and he looked back up with this little sheepish look on his face, and he said, well, I meant xenophobia. This is some leader. I mean, he's gone now, but exophobia. I guess I was afraid of the letter X. I don't even want to think about what the letter Y would do to me. And Z, whew, we'll have to save that for another day. Exophobia. This is about name-calling and intimidation. How are we being represented by our elected representatives, there's that word, folks, when they vilify any American who dares to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, guys, you're going the wrong way on a one-way street. In-state tuition for illegal aliens, which means that the schools will get less money, well, they're going to make up the shortfall, and guess who's going to pay for it? You will, or your children will, or their children will. That's what this is about. So when Americans dare to stand up and say, you guys are making bad decisions, you need to be made accountable, instead of saying, gee whiz, I'm sorry, we will have to work with you, they say, wait a minute, that's a mob out there, or those are crazy people out there. Maybe what's really out there, folks, are our fellow Americans, our neighbors, family members, perhaps, who are finally getting it. Maybe they've been taking to heart that little phrase that I love so much, that democracy is not a spectator sport. And maybe that's what's got the politicians so damn rattled. You know, Abraham Lincoln, and I just wrote an article for CAPS, so I presume it'll be on their website shortly, but I said that the demonstrators were demonstrating that Lincoln was right, because Abraham Lincoln very sagely said, you can fool all the people some of the time and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. And that's what's being done and has been done for decades. Politicians were counting on the American people being stupid and self-absorbed and more concerned with who was going to win Dancing with the Stars or winning some idiotic reality program, rather than being concerned about what was happening to their country, what was happening to their futures, what was happening to their thin grip on the American dream. And by the way, today, the Justice Department, here we go again, went after the state of Alabama, went to the appeals court, because the lower court ruled basically in favor of Alabama's immigration law. So now they're appealing it and saying, please don't let them enforce their immigration laws. But meanwhile, Obama, President Obama, will get on TV and talk about all these hardworking Americans and how unfair things are. Well, I doubt that Mr. Obama is listening to me. But if he was, I would tell him, Mr. President, you are undermining every American worker when you fail to enforce the immigration laws. As the executive, chief executive of the United States, as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and the commander-in-chief, in point of fact, for our federal law enforcement agencies, he took an oath to uphold the Constitution, to defend our country, to enforce its laws. You don't get to pick the laws the way you pick items on a Chinese menu. You know, I'll take the wonton soup, but no egg roll. It doesn't work that way where laws are concerned. The American people have had enough. And I think the time has come for Americans to respect each other, even if we disagree with each other. Remember this business about peaceably assembling. Let's have those conversations, folks. Let's have the discourse. When I was a kid, I was told you don't discuss politics or religion in polite company. Religion, I agree. That's about as personal as it gets. Whether a person has a relationship with God or does not, that's up to the individual, and the Founding Fathers would certainly support me on that. But the discussions about politics, we better have those conversations. We better have that discourse. And instead of looking at the guy that disagrees with you as your enemy, let's look at each other as allies. We're in this together. E pluribus unum. This isn't about dividing America up by ethnicity or race or religion. We're better than that. That's not what America is about. And it's not about dividing ourselves up as blue or red. Oh, he's a Tea Party. Oh, he's a... No, folks, let's stop. Let's stop. Reasonable, sane people want pretty much the same things for themselves and their families. We may disagree about how to get to that destination, but we want security. We want safety. We want to get our little slice of the American dream. We want our children to live better than we did. That's what most Americans want. And we can have those discussions, and maybe in the process of discussing things, we'll all learn from each other. I'm certainly not afraid to debate somebody who disagrees with me. I look forward to those encounters because they are an opportunity to exchange ideas. I've been involved with the immigration issue for 40 years, and believe me, I don't have all the answers. Nobody does. Only a fool would think he or she had all the answers. Or they'd have to be a member of Congress, but then I'd be redundant, wouldn't I? We have an obligation to each other, folks. We have an obligation to our country. We have an obligation to our children and to their children to be the best Americans that we could be and to stop this rancor. Because that's what the politicians want. That's what the special interest groups want. They want Americans so busy beating each other up that we ignore the skullduggery being perpetrated in Washington by the great majority of those people who purportedly represent us. They're not representing us, most of them anyway. There's a couple of good guys, but you have to look far and wide to find them. My dad used to tell me that we are treated, or we will be treated, the way that we tell people to treat us. You know, we teach people how they should treat us by what we're willing to accept. Those folks out on the street, if they're there for the right reasons, they're serving this country. What they are doing is to be patriotic. Go back and look at the First Amendment. Go back and reread it, please. As long as there's no violence. And even if you disagree with them, that's cool. We're supposed to disagree. That's our birthright as Americans. Let's stand united as Americans. Let's come to conclusions together as Americans. Let's figure out how the greatest number of Americans can once again get their piece of the American dream through hard work and diligence and creativity, maybe a little bit of luck, a little gumption thrown in. That's what America is supposed to be about. We can have disagreements, but that doesn't mean that we're each other's enemy. This idea of vilifying each other is harmful to us, it's harmful to the country, and it's exactly what the politicians who are stabbing us in the back expect of us. Let them fight among themselves. They're talking about us when they say that. And then they can come in and get what they want. Divide and conquer. Not this time. I think we're smarter than that, folks. It's been a pleasure spending an hour with you. You know, this is the beginning of the Day of Atonement, the new Jewish New Year. And whether you're Jewish or not, it doesn't matter. But, you know, no matter how you measure your year, I hope that this coming year brings peace, happiness, health, and success for everybody. I thank you for spending the last hour with me. I look forward to joining you again next week at the same time, right here, between 7 and 8 o'clock on the USA Talk Radio Network on the Michael Cutler Hour. Again, folks, I'm glad I could spend an hour with you. Have a wonderful weekend. See you next week.